2022 was a golden year for women across a number of UK sports. The Lionesses won the European Championships and the women's rugby team made the World Cup final. But in wider society, there still remains challenges of discrimination, stigma and lack of opportunities, including access to healthcare education awareness for women. So today, I'm delighted to be joined by an incredible panel from media, from sport and from healthcare to discuss and digest some of those challenges, to talk about how do we empower women for equal opportunities and how do we collectively work for a more positive society that is equal for women and men. Now, sport and physical activity has a real opportunity to change the trajectory, as does the media, to really address some of the issues. And I know many of you are in those spaces and have had experienced different issues as women or working with women or supporting women in healthcare. So, and as we know with our Tackle HIV campaign, sport and the media are critical to changing attitudes. So a little bit about the campaign. So Tackle HIV was established by Gareth with Veef Healthcare, who I proudly work for, and in partnership with the Terence Higgins Trust. And what we are trying to do is break down barriers of people's perceptions and views of people living with HIV and the stigma that surrounds that. But today we're really focusing on women because actually women are underserved in the HIV response. But it isn't just about HIV, and therefore to dig in and really understand some of those gender inequities in HIV, we really need to discuss, unpack, understand and change those inequities for women more broadly across the world. So, to introduce my fellow panellists today, I'm very excited to have Gareth, CBE, Welsh Rugby International, and British and Irish Lions captain, and our partner in crime on the Tackle HIV campaign. So welcome, Gareth.
Thank you.
We also have Kate Richardson-Walsh, who is joining us virtually. So Kate is OBE and the England and Great Britain Hockey Olympic champion. We have Natalie Pinkham. Welcome, Natalie, television presenter and Formula One reporter. Sally Gunnell, OBE, Olympic and world champion athlete. There's a lot of letters and honours sitting around me here. And another, Becky Mitchell, MBE, and a HIV advocate. And then Dr. Neka Nkwolo, a brilliant colleague and friend, and the head of global patient affairs at Veef Healthcare, but also a consultant HIV physician. Also joining us virtually is Professor Kevin Fenton, as the public health physician and infectious diseases expert. I'm Helen McDowell, and I head up government affairs and global public health at Veef Healthcare. So I'm going to start with a question. I'm going to work out who to go to first, but really just to get you to reflect on your personal experiences in your industry and your field. What have your experience have been as a woman? And what barriers have you faced?
Yeah, I think it's when you're in it at the time, and you know we're going back sort of 25, 30 years now to when I was winning my gold medal. You don't actually think about it so much because, but when you come away from the book, you actually sort of realise that there was battles all the time. And I think that in some respects, it made me want to prove myself. And that's how I looked at it. But, and I also realised that, you know, coming second or third, you know, in a European Championships, and then my male counterparts were getting so much more coverage. You know, I wouldn't even get a sentence. And I always remember back there thinking, well, do you know what? I've just got to do one better. I've got to, you know, I've got to win. And I do actually remember winning that Olympic gold medal and still not getting the coverage. That Linda Christie was still on the front pages and, you know, the sponsorship that everybody talked about was still not happening. And it probably wasn't until the following year of breaking a world record and winning a world that people were actually starting to, oh, okay. So I now look back at that time and I think we were so far away in women's sport. You know, I was the only woman that won then, and it is massive gaps. And maybe there was a little tiny, you know, little gap that was closed. I think 2012 made a big difference with the success of Jessica Ennis and having, you know, the Olympics in our country. I think you can see those barriers And, you know, to see the progression, you know, you talked about the women's football and rugby, and to see that girls are now can play and how far we've come. But we're still, it's still often about what you look like. It's still not always about your actual performance. It's still often about what you say and these sorts of things, and undermined that you don't train hard enough, and that we've, and we're, you know, and still that sort of the payment gap. You know, we see in so many sports still, it's still not equal. So there are so many gaps that still need to be drawn into.
Wow, a lot of things there. So media, training, funding.
Yep.
All playing sort of quite a pivotal role, but great to see that your resilience actually used that gap to actually spur you on to change that. And yeah, certainly I was watching you, you know, as you ran that Olympic as a young girl wanting to be passionate about it.
And Natalie, maybe I can come to you. Obviously, you're on a slightly different side of sport, and obviously Formula One, very male dominant as a sport.
I always say about Formula One is that it is a meritocracy. And if you work hard and you believe in what you're doing and you show willing, you will succeed. The hard bit is getting in. Once you're in, it is... you are given the opportunity to flourish. But when, you know, I've been in the sport 12 years now, and I was about the only girl there initially, and would always get the sort of token totty shoots, like the fluff. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I wasn't given the serious stuff. Yeah. I mean, I wanted to talk about tyres.
Yeah.
They didn't let me talk about tyres. I don't really want to talk about tyres. But it was interesting because that has definitely changed now. More and more girls are coming in. And what I'm finding so interesting is that we are having the conversation, and the boys behave better the more girls are around. So it's like, you know, men shouldn't be threatened by more women coming in. If anything, it's that whole rising tide lifts all ships. I think there really is a benefit to more inclusion.
And are their comments being taken seriously when...
Well, it's interesting because I think so. Definitely, particularly with this proliferation of social media, is that a lot of girls are going out there and creating their own content. And they're thinking, oh, actually, this is interesting. Drive to Survive has been a massive factor in this.
Yeah.
The growth in women watching sport has been exponential. And what we do as broadcasters now, the crucial part is to hang on to those new female viewers and say, you know what, this is a party to which you're all invited. And the massive trailblazer in all of this has been Lewis Hamilton. Because, you know, he is still the only male of colour driving in... He's the only black man to have ever raced in Formula One.
Wow,
I mean, that is just...
In
2023,
that.
That's shocking, isn't it?
Wow.
And, but he's brilliant because he wants diversity in terms of gender and sexual orientation and colour and background. He wants to open it up in terms of... You know, there's a lot of socioeconomic barriers to people coming to Formula One. It's always been seen as a very white... very rich, elitist sport, and very male-dominated. I mean, the stats recently were 88% male, 91% white.
Wow.
And that's, I mean, that's got to change. And it is changing. It's just not happening quickly enough. But I'll tell you one anecdote, and this was so interesting to me, is that someone put a photo down in front of me of the 10 team principals, and they put it down, and they said, what did you notice about that picture? And they'd all gone out for dinner. The 10 team principals in Formula One had gone out for dinner. And I looked at the picture and I looked and I looked and I thought, I know, Toto and Christian are sitting on the other side of the table. They hate each other, don't they? And they went, no. See, even you didn't notice or didn't say there were no women in that picture. And I thought, my God, I am complicit. I'm part of the problem. I didn't even challenge the fact that there were no people of colour and no women. There were no black men and no women in that picture, and that was shocking to me. And I thought, I walked away a bit ashamed of myself because I thought, you know, perhaps, you know, I've become institutionalised and I'm part of the problem now. So I have to keep pushing back and saying, actually, that's not good enough.
Yeah.
We are welcome at that table.
And I think that's a really important point because that is actually a lot, you know, society is geared up, you know, largely driven by men. And you look at the various reports that have come out recently about gender pay gaps, you know, women at work, etc. They all demonstrate there's still this preponderance of male dominance and sort of difference in how men are treated. Yet, actually, there aren't a huge number of women who are challenging it because it's almost become accepted that that's just the way the world works. So I think the importance of remaining open-eyed to it and being advocates for change and agitators to keep pushing for that difference is going to be really important. And I'm just going to quickly turn to Kate, because I know from the hockey world that you've experienced some challenges versus how men are treated in the hockey world.
Yeah, I mean, thanks firstly for having me on. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Hockey's an interesting one, because I think externally, when people say, when I say I'll play hockey, I think people often think of it as a female sport. And that depends just on where you come from in the country, what school you went to, what you did at school, and what the boys did at school. Actually, it's much more nuanced than that. I think I've been really fortunate over my career that our funding is UK sport funding at the elite level. And that's always been quite equitable. That's been pretty fair across the board throughout my career. But then if you just get below the surface of that, there are lots of inequalities. And probably for the most of my career, probably till I was about 28, 29, I just thought that's the way it was. I didn't think I was experiencing sexism. I didn't think there was any kind of, I didn't understand what the patriarchy was. I didn't understand any of that. And so it just, this is just how it is. But there were lots of little things showing up all of the time, like throughout our training careers, throughout our international careers, just things like Sydney, my first Olympic Games, we didn't have any female specific kit. It was unisex, which means, men's kit, and we get the small men's kit. We didn't have our own changing rooms in when we played at club. Like the men's first team would have their own changing room they could keep their stuff in. We'd just be sharing with all the other women's teams who'd be coming through. The language that's used by coaches, the availability of pitches and facilities for us to train at the appropriate time or the best time for us was always given to the men first. So there were so many small things like that. And then there were some like big structural things. So real lack of opportunity. So there was a European Hockey League for the domestic clubs. For the men since 2007, there is still today no female equivalent of that. They had an Indian Premier League. So like where, the players were kind of bought and sold on a market and they played for different teams, no female equivalent. And all of that means that sponsors look at that and say, okay, well, I'm not going to give you as much money as this male player because you're not going to get seen at the European Hockey League. You're not going to get seen at the Hockey India League. So therefore I can say, I'm going to pay you four times less, even though you're internationally more successful, you've got Olympic medals, I'm going to pay you four times less. And that's exactly what happened to me. And that just has massive ramifications in every way. Yes, in terms of money and sponsorship, but also how you feel about yourself, how much value you feel you have as a woman. And, that you can see the seeds being sown from a really young age in boys and girls already, what is deemed to be the best and what's, secondary, is just sown into the fabric of the sport, and not just hockey, in lots of different sports.
Neka, obviously, as a very experienced physician in the UK healthcare world, can I ask you a bit more around your experience of as a healthcare provider, both for people living with HIV and women living with HIV, but also more broadly, how do you think healthcare is different for women in the UK?
So that's a really good question. So thinking about HIV specifically, and you alluded to this at the beginning, women tend to be diagnosed late. So they tend to be diagnosed with HIV when they've had HIV unknowingly for a long time, and they come to see their GP, or actually more commonly, a visit to hospital because they're really unwell with advanced disease. And a lot of that is because women themselves don't necessarily perceive themselves to be at risk of HIV, and there are many, many different reasons for that. But also because, in general, clinicians don't think that women are at risk. And so I have had many patients who have presented with all sorts of strange conditions that nobody really understood, and have been sent to lots and lots of different specialists to have investigations for all sorts of things, and no one has ever thought about doing an HIV test. Mm-hmm. If those women were to come to a sexual health clinic where HIV is known about, then they would have been diagnosed early. But actually, we also know that a lot of women don't go to sexual health clinics because they don't necessarily feel that they're at risk of particular STIs, and so they don't get tested. And so it's really, and this is one reason that TACL is so important, because it really does raise awareness of the fact that HIV is something that anybody can get, and encourages everybody to test, regardless of their perception of risk or not. But coming back to your question about healthcare, I mean, we know, and there've been lots and lots of media reports about the sort of inequalities in terms of the way that women who do access healthcare are treated.
Becky, can I come to you? Obviously, you know, what's your experience been through your career and your journey with HIV as a woman?
Well, I was diagnosed just over 10 years ago, so not many women were talking about it then. So when I went public with it, I had quite a lot of questions about, well, how's that happened to you? Questioning my practices and things like that, when actually I'm a heterosexual woman, but having to justify that. But still, that idea that it was just affecting men. And not many women were talking about it then, and there were a lot of women living with HIV. And I went along to a couple of women's groups and sort of talking to people who were afraid to say anything, because there was the thing of violence towards women as well. There's so much stuff to talk about, isn't there? And the healthcare things and people not going and getting tested because they didn't think that they were at risk. But it's a virus just like anything else, that it doesn't discriminate, does it? It doesn't care. It just wants a host.
And the other thing, just to add to what you were saying, is we did a symposium recently at the big HIV conference in Seattle. And a lot of the women were saying that actually they get a lot of judgment from clinicians.
Yes.
So if a woman felt that she wanted to have a test, she'd be made to feel as if there was something wrong with her for wanting to have a test.
Yeah.
And I have a colleague, actually, a doctor colleague, who asked for a test at her GP surgery. And she was told, oh, no, women, ladies like you don't get that sort of thing.
Which is mad, actually, because the one positive step forward has been, in the UK, every female is tested for HIV during pregnancy,
yes,
unless they opt out of it.
Yes.
So it's, why is that sort of, why is it acceptable? And I don't know anyone who's ever declined that test at that point. So how do we normalise that? Because it should be a part of general sexual health, well-being. And it shouldn't just be about HIV tests. It should be about the suite of things for your sexual health and well-being and good relationships. And we're going to end up coming back to education. You'll know that I've got a 10-year-old daughter here, because the reality of some of these things, I think, are missing from school education, that actually are opportunities to normalise some of these things from a very, very young age. And I think, you know, sport, media, television, there are many areas where you don't see that happening, and the opportunities to change that so that the next generation isn't set with accepting that this is okay.
What made you decide to go public?
Oh gosh, I think it was more at the time I kind of felt really poisoned and toxic, and I thought, and I'm quite an open person anyway, was really, I'm not like sporty like you guys are, but I train a lot, I run a lot, and you know, I coach people.
You probably train more than any of us on this table back.
I don't look like it, I don't think. And I kind of wanted to just show, I think when I was first diagnosed, I was doing lots of cycling, long distance cycling, and I just thought, I've got all these like long distance rides coming up, can I still do them? Because back then I didn't know. And so the doctor sort of said to me, you know, you'll be absolutely fine, but life will be quite uncertain. So it was more about, I'm going to just take charge of this and show that I can still do all this, because it made me still feel like me at a time where I was really struggling to come to terms with it. It's the mental and emotional side of it more than the physical side, because I've never had any symptoms of it physically. And I thought, well, if I can just, you know, show that this is happening to women, and that there are a wider group of women, and that they didn't feel able to speak, but maybe I could help give them a voice as well. That was part of it.
That's amazing.
So, Becky, how, in that 10 years where you've been public, how do you think attitudes have changed, or have they?
Yeah, definitely. There's more women talking about it now publicly, especially over the last year, I've noticed, on the Terence Higgins Trust and a couple of people that you've done stuff with on Tackle as well. So I think attitudes are changing, but it's still quite slow. And I still think we could do more. But I think having you speaking up as well is a massive help.
Yeah, and thank you, Becky, for everything you've done for Tackle. Yeah, you're such a huge part of the campaign.
Huge
and
part.
Gareth, now obviously, over both with Tackle, but way before that, you have been a very strong advocate and supporter of women in sport and an ally. And maybe you can reflect on how you've seen those challenges play out for women, but also maybe reflect on, have they changed?
Do you like this 5-to-1 ratio?
I love it. I love it. I think I've never felt that comfortable in my entire life.
Brilliant.
I swear. But it's quite really interesting, because being an ally, like I've been an ally of females in sport in particular, because sport is always my thing from a young age. And when you become an ally in sport, you kind of get found guilty by association. So I was kind of, you know, I was deemed sometimes to be gay because I supported women in sport. And even now, I think when men want to support women in sport, they get kind of tarred as being a little bit female themselves, you know, and we all have a bit of femininity in us, so there's nothing wrong with showing it. But one thing I found, and one thing I've listened to really carefully, because I've listened intently, because I think there's one thing, you know, if you really listen, you really learn, right? And one thing that I've heard so often is kind of this disparity between two words, and two words that are really important, and one is progression, and one is change. And to understand that those two words are kind of poles apart. Because if you don't progress towards change, then progression is pointless. And I think sometimes we allow to look back at ourselves and say, well, do you know what, we're in a better, and men in particular, you know, I see a lot of men saying this, especially about female sport, is like, well, you look back at 20 years ago and you never see a game of football on the television. So you know what, we've progressed, it's enough. It's like, okay, so you've seen one game over, so you're saying we were bad 20 years ago, we're still bad now because we just see kind of like one game of football. So it isn't equality, understanding what equality is. So for me, I feel it's really important to understand that as much as we think we've progressed, we have to keep fighting for that end point of change. Mm. You know, when people change their perceptions, otherwise, it's really easy to keep progressing to nowhere.
100% agree. I'm really mindful of being grateful and acknowledging progress and celebrating the fact that we are moving forward, because we are. But I also don't want to be grateful for crumbs. You know, as I said, the kind of European Hockey Federation have created a version of the European Hockey League for women. But as I said, it's not an equivalent. And therefore you feel that you have to be so grateful for these little things that people are feeding you. And actually, do you know what? No, let's not be grateful. Let's just ask for more, demand more. And until we get to equity, I think we need to stay kind of on our guard and be a bit angry and be a bit pushy and be prepared to have some hard conversations, because otherwise we're never going to get anywhere.
What does change look like then?
Change to me is equality. Change to me is equality of thought. Equality of, if we talk about Becky's case, for instance, you know, it was way more acceptable for me to speak about my HIV diagnosis because I'm a gay man. And people are kind of like, okay, yeah, you know what? I've seen and I've heard of cases of gay men. I'm HIV before. The 80s told me that it was a disease that would only affect gay and bisexual men. So do you know what? To a point, it can be acceptable. For me, change is a point when it's as acceptable for me to be open as my diagnosis. And yeah, I get treated with stigma and I get treated with discrimination. But because I'm living with HIV, not because I'm a man living with HIV. So I think change is when it comes to being almost you're discriminated the same or you're celebrated the same. But there's equality in that thought.
In
there's
the equality
in the thought.
Yeah.
You get that opportunity when you are being educated at that young age,
exactly.
Isn't it?
That it's not even... Yeah.
Exactly. It's like, well, you can't really go and do that because girls don't do that sport. And now it's great that they are getting that, but not everywhere. And I think it's really important because sometimes they say that,
you know, lots of girls that are coming through, they can't ever relate to somebody in sport that's winning. And I think this is where we go back to the press and media and how important that they tell their stories. Because I think often, you know, with the guys, you are telling their story all the way through. And then you can see people be inspired to, I can actually do that. And I think we still need to be able to do that as a woman. It's not just we've achieved at the top, but actually we've all started in the same area and this is my story, this is what I've gone through, I've had this opportunity and it has been battles, and be able to share it to be those role models that they need to be.
That's the broadcaster's responsibility. I genuinely feel that it's our duty to shine the light on the stories coming through. Yeah. And actually we got a lot of criticism at the time when we banned, too strong a word, but we no longer used grid girls in Formula One. They were like, I thought you wanted more women in sport, not less. And I said, no, but we want the right role models. We don't want want a girl that's not speaking for a start and is purely judged on the way she looks, standing in front of the car, an inanimate object. We want girls to turn the TV on and have relatable role models working, whether it's behind the scenes as engineers, whether it's in the car. And ultimately, there is nothing physically that precludes a woman from driving an F1 car. No. So they need to see it to be it. And it is happening, but you almost had to take a little shuffle back to then push forward.
And we're now joined by Professor Kevin Fenton, who's a public health physician and infectious diseases expert. So welcome, Kevin, to the round table, and thanks for joining us today. You know, really excited to get your views and you know, conversation along with the superstar panel that I have alongside me from the media and sports world. Obviously, you are a deep health expert and have been for a long time. And we've been discussing some of the statistics around and the realities of people accepting the inequalities that face women in society today, and it's just accepted that that's just the way things are. Now, interestingly, there's some statistics from the UK that suggest that only 23% of people really see that the differences in how men and women are treated is a serious inequality.
Thank you. It's so good to be here and to have the chance to discuss with you and reflect on these issues when it comes to women's health, gender differences in women's experience, and how that plays out in a number of health areas. In my role here in London, not only do I cover HIV and HIV prevention, but wider health issues, from the prevention of chronic diseases, infectious diseases, general health conditions. And what I see in my role is that these gender differences play themselves out across the entire health pathway. So when it comes to health literacy and women's engagement in their health, women's ability to access services, we know that women tend to be more likely to be engaged in services because of their reproductive health demands. But there also are challenges when it comes to the services which are offered for women, diagnostic delays for some of the health conditions for women, and that therefore plays out in health outcomes. And then within women, for different women in different economic backgrounds, racial and ethnic backgrounds, across age differences, we also see variations as well. So in general, for women who are more older, more experienced with the services, they're much more likely to be engaged and much more likely to be able to navigate the system. For younger women, especially women from more disadvantaged backgrounds, from minority backgrounds, we tend to see real challenges with accessing the services that they need. So gender has a really important role to play in women's experience, in women's outcomes, and in the services that they achieve. And that's why shining a light on this is so important.
That's quite, there's a lot in there, isn't there? And Neka, if I can call on you, obviously, I mean, HIV is unfortunately grounded in inequities. It is an infection that is driven by inequalities and perpetuated by inequalities. And obviously, you know, some of the pieces that Kevin's mentioned there around the socioeconomic differences of women. So even the challenges that we face is probably relatively, economically supported women is probably very different if we look across the real breadth of women. And how does that unpack in healthcare from your experience?
I mean, I think Kevin raises some really important points about the socioeconomic disadvantages that can impact upon women's experiences of and access to healthcare. So when we think about HIV, for example, it happens that the majority of women living with HIV in the United Kingdom come from minority ethnic backgrounds, many from parts of Africa, for example, many of whom either come here, so immigrate into the UK or are born to families who have immigrated. But if you come to the UK as a migrant and are not familiar with the healthcare system or have, for example, insecure migration status, then you're unlikely to access healthcare because you're frightened that you might be deported or that you might be entitled to it. And so then you don't seek healthcare.
It's so complex, isn't it? There's so many different pieces to pull together, but ultimately healthcare and well-being play into everyone's ability to live fulfilling, happy and viable long lives. So how, on a broader sense, Kevin, what do you think could be done differently to address that challenge? Obviously it's not just a healthcare problem and obviously something that we can discuss more broadly is obviously how do we address that gap about, for women, but also the socioeconomic piece that obviously disproportionately is another layer on top impacting women. What are your thoughts on it from a broader healthcare sense?
The important thing is that we are beginning to shine a light on these differences and have open, honest, and authentic conversations about these inequalities, and that the status quo is not acceptable. And I think change starts at that point. For too long, we haven't had the data, nor have we had the conversations to say that these differences that women are experiencing are not right. They're not just, and we need to address them. The second, in addition to these authentic conversations, is ensuring that we have good data. And that data is important because that is the foundation for the policies that we develop and the programs that we develop. And I know that many of you will be looking at, as people working in sports, physical activity, understanding the power of data to help you to make better decisions is key. And in health, we need those data too to design programs that will meet the needs of women. The third thing, which I think is important, is ensuring that women are centered in the decision-making around the policies and programs that we develop with and for them. The days are long gone that, we can stay in a closed room, develop programs that we think will work for women and then deliver it. We have to ensure that women are there at the start, at the center of designing programs, thinking about their needs, understanding and responding to their needs so that the programs that we develop really work. And this is exactly what we're doing, for example, for HIV, where we are working with community organizations which are bringing women in from various communities and backgrounds to help to understand the real problems, but to find solutions that work for them. And my responsibility as a policymaker is to unlock the funding and to unlock the sort of ways in which the system works to meet the needs of women. So in summary, I think authentic conversations, having good data, but most importantly, centering the work around women's lives and experiences. I think those are some of the things that we need to do.
Brilliant. And I think that can translate across every single sector that we work in. So Natalie, can I come to you, I think, to reflect on sort of the sport media side of things? Are those authentic conversations happening there? And who is flying the flag?
Conversations are happening. I think, again, going back to what I mentioned earlier about Lewis Hamilton being a very loud voice in this space, and people have to listen when you're a seven-time world champion. Mm. You dictate the agenda, and that's great. And for me, the difference between a sporting great and a sporting icon is using your platform to good effect. Cases in point. but seriously, what's the point of having that level of status if you're not going to do something powerful with it and having a legacy, so the conversations are happening. I'm seeing change. I'm excited by it, but we have to keep that momentum up. And again, it's allyship is everything, because quite often I can see the guys in our team, some saying, well, hang on a minute, there's not room for everyone. So if you're going to bring more women in, you know, someone's going to have to go. But actually, it's about working together. And for me, this is a train going in one direction. You've got to jump on board. You've got to be prepared to adapt. And that gives longevity to your own career anyway, doesn't it? If you're, you know, no industry is...
Yeah.
Remains unchanged, and it's about not being scared of that change and embracing it and going with it and recognising that that represents progress for everyone.
Okay, I'll reflect a little bit maybe from the private sector, obviously working for a corporate business where, you know, this is a hugely important piece for us. Diversity, inclusivity and equity are of huge importance to us as a global pharmaceutical company, but they are something that we are held to account to by our shareholders, by our stakeholders, by investors, and by society, and rightly so. And we report on those numbers every year, and we've been pushing hard to make sure that we are reducing that inequity in our employment and the way in which that people in the business are supported, but also in the research that we do to better reflect the populations who are impacted by the diseases, the infections, and the areas that we are researching to deliver new innovations for. Now, obviously, in that culture, we always have targets, and the whole sort of piece of what gets measured gets done. Now, the reality is our sports federations, are the media held to account on targets similarly to the private sector? You know, the public sector in terms of setting targets about reaching marginalised populations, supporting women, their retention in care. You know, I just want to put out there the thought that, you know, are there learns that are transferable from how the private sector is held to account that could be applied across other areas to really help catalyse and reduce that gender inequity? I don't know who wants to go first with responding to that. I don't know, Kevin, you know, any thoughts from your side from a public sector lens?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what you've described is that process of leadership, engagement and commitment, a clear strategy that guides the organization's efforts, metrics to understand how we're progressing and accountability systems. And thankfully, we're in an environment now where both for HIV, through the HIV Action Plan, we have exactly that. And I have the privilege of being the government's chief advisor on HIV, overseeing the implementation of the HIV Action Plan. And we have metrics and targets, we have work streams, we have delivery plans, and we're pushing on that. And at the same time, you'll remember last summer, the first women's health strategy for England was also released. And that also has a bold vision for the first time, really clear lanes where we want to see real improvements for women's health. And now what we're doing, for example, in London and other regions across the country, are working to develop delivery plans on this. So those same principles of strategy and governance and leadership, et cetera, are what we're applying in the public sector as well. And we have to do this because, you know, resources are tight and we need to ensure that what we're spending on is having an impact. So this approach is certainly what we're doing for women's health and HIV.
I'm going to use a quote by John Amici. So John Amici is he's a psychologist now. He was an NBA basketballer. And he talks about culture being defined by the worst behaviour tolerated in yourself and others. And so if you think about culture, society is our culture, right? We belong to society. We are part of the culture. What do we tolerate in ourselves? And what do we tolerate in the people around us that are holding women back? And when I say women, I do mean across the board. I mean all women. Some of our ingrained biases and our privilege, like, do we understand it? Are we able to unpick it? Are we able to hold ourselves to account? The thoughts that we have, the words that come out of our mouths, you know, the behaviours that we show, and are we able to start in a positive way, start challenging also then the people around us? Because I think that's what it's going to take. I think if we all do our bit, at whatever, you know, level we are, whatever we're doing, I think it will make a difference. It's incremental. I think it's about holding ourselves and each other to account.
So I'd like to get into a little bit about how you think women were perceived, you know, in your industries, and then we'll get into a bit more about what are we going to do about changing that. Neka, can I start with you?
Well, I think, you know, I think in medicine we've come a very long way. There was a time when there were no female doctors, and women have really struggled. But over 50% of applicants to medical school are women. That doesn't necessarily translate to who gets to be a consultant. We see attrition as time goes on, because some women leave to have children, for example, and then either never come back or don't come back at the same level. There is a very big difference between some specialties as to how successful a woman might be. And, you know, there are, for example, more women in general practice than there are, for example, in some of the specialties. So there is still a lot of work to be done. I think, yeah, but the question is always about how fast progress is being made. And I think in most areas, it's never fast enough. And so we shouldn't be complacent about it. And I think we do need to question those specialties where there isn't a lot of representation of women, to try to understand why that is. Because often it's because an environment is not created which allows women to thrive and to flourish in those specialties. And that needs to be addressed, I think.
And keeping to the medical theme, Kevin, you know, what would be your view of kind of the perceived role of women in the public health sector?
Yeah, so I agree with Neka's reflections on how things have changed in medicine. And in fact, public health has perhaps been at the leading edge of this change. We are a female-dominated, a woman-dominated specialty, and the vast majority now of our new trainees coming in tend to be women. Because public health is a fantastic specialty, but it also enables you to have a better balance of life and work, I think. But now what we're looking at is, even though we're having many more women coming into the specialty, we need to go beyond that data. So we need to go a little bit deeper, looking at equality, diversity, inclusion, ensuring that we have really good pathways for minority candidates. We know that coming into medicine, you're more likely to be successful and to be a medical student if you have parents who are doctors or parents who are professionals. So we also need to look at ensuring that the opportunities for coming into medicine and public health are open to people from different backgrounds, and that we have that diversity and inclusion in the pathway as well. And then what's really interesting is how we are adapting the specialty to meet the needs and lives of women today and of all workers today.
So Natalie, obviously I'm focusing on Formula One because I know that's what you've done for sort of the last good number of years, but obviously you've got a broader experience in that. How has the role of women, you know, what is it perceived as when you first started, and where is it now?
Well, interestingly, one of the hardest parts that I was sort of building towards through my career was when to try and have children. And I didn't want to get to a point where I couldn't then have kids and think, what did I do? And I remember being so nervous about telling my boss that I was pregnant. And his response was incredible. And there wasn't even a millisecond, a nanosecond of doubt in his mind. He was like, great. That's fantastic news. I thought, really? Is it? Because then you have a baby and then you think you forget everything. Well, I did actually forget everything. Baby brain is a thing, right? And the imposter syndrome creeps in. And then people tell you that you're going to have imposter syndrome. So then it's self-perpetuating. You're like, hang on a minute. Do I have to have imposter syndrome? And actually, I had a great chat with a girl only yesterday who said, let's just do away with this imposter syndrome nonsense. Do men have it? No, but we're told we should have it, therefore we have it. And then we go into work riddled with doubt and thinking, I can't do this. That, to me, was a pivotal moment in my career. And to have the support of work was crucial. And then, actually, I remember walking through the paddock one day in Formula One, and one of the girls in catering from McLaren came over to me and went, please just keep going. And I went, oh God, can you tell I'm struggling? And she was like, no, but I'm a working mum and I need to see you pushing forward and I need to see other people support you. And this is what I found, is there's this incredible sisterhood, and there are so many women supporting other women in Formula One now. There's a real community, and I gained such strength from that. And actually I gained such strength from moments like this, because I'm normally, you know, the only woman with all men, and however much they try to relate, it's impossible. So thank you for today, because I feel uplifted and energized by just talking to you.
Awesome. Thank you. Now, Gareth, what about your experience from a rugby lens? Obviously, you've worked for many years in actually and supported many sports, but obviously rugby being the big one. How was the perception of women in rugby?
Well, first, when I first started playing, there was no perception of women in rugby because women, as far as men were concerned, that the rugby field wasn't their place. It wasn't a sport that was accessible to them. The women's game always took, or used to kind of take more of a back seat. So it would always be pre the main event, so pre the man's game.
Like the
or
undercard.
Post the men's event, so post the man's game, which is the main game. And people used to always make this huge comparison between the female game that they saw and the male game and understand that it was completely different.
Kate, what are your thoughts on this?
Yes, and those biases run deep, and they're in me. Like they're in me because I'm living in the world. I'm surrounded by people who think like that, who think the men's hockey game is better because they throw longer aerials, or they score more penalty corners, or they're hitting the ball harder. Like that is seen as better. But I've heard so many male commentators over the years kind of really put the women's game down and be really patronising and like, oh, another, we've got to have to get through this game. And I'm like, do you know how many bad men's hockey games I've seen? Just as many as bad women's games. As you said, there are good and bad games across the genders. There are highly skilled people and there are athletic people. And there are all these different kinds of people that make up these sports and in these teams. I watch women's tennis and men's tennis in a different way. I watch women's rugby and men's rugby in a different way. And actually, I've heard a lot of people since then, when they've gone to watch women's rugby, or they've gone to watch the WSL or women's cricket, and they'll be, the purists are like, oh, like I love this, because it's taken them back to not all this hype and all this stuff that's surrounding men's sport, because it's professional and it's bigger. You just get the purity of the sport and of the technique and the expertise and the quality and the skill and the passion. And I think that's what women's sport, like the key that we're really leveraging on that. And I think that's why the crowds are growing for Women's Super League, Lionesses, Women's England Red Roses, as you said. It's growing.
I was just going to add one thing. I said earlier that there's nothing that physically precludes a woman from driving in Formula One. There is one thing in the pathway to Formula One is power steering. So, and I know this because my colleague Naomi Schiff has brought this up with me, and she said, we actually just have to be honest about what is stopping more women coming through. And it's so interesting that the lower formulae, they rely on they don't have power steering, so it's much physically harder to control the car. And yet you get to Formula One and there's power steering and it's much more of an equal playing field, but it's getting to Formula One that's the key. Mm. So actually, they're just something as simple as that. Just invest, if you really want to see women coming through, invest, give power steering in F2, then you're going to see more women in it, and then actually that will be levelled out because you don't need it in Formula One anyway, you don't need that extra physical strength to compete.
If I think about athletics, women weren't allowed to run the marathon because they didn't think they were physically able until the 1980s. They didn't think that it was too far and they couldn't physically do it. So we've had to come a long way. Pole vault, women's 400 hurdles came in the 1984 Olympics. So, that we weren't physically able to do that. So, and that was only the 80s. So that's how far it's come. So it's then building up. Yes, I think the biggest thing that held me back was people actually didn't think that women were confident enough, strong enough mentally. You're too weak. You're not tough enough. And that was another element. So you come from the physical side of it, yes, we can do this, to then the confidence of actually we are tough enough and we can put ourselves on the line, to, where we're starting to go now. But it did, it's still, I always, so often when I'm working in organisations or within sport, it is the confidence and allowing women to say, you can do this, you are able.
So
and it does still get knocked out of us. So I think a lot of it is around just that confidence. And Becky, what about you? How would you reflect back and give advice to your younger self based on the journey that you've been on and what you've learned and how you've been empowered?
Oh, gosh, yeah, that is a good question. Because I didn't really have that many... There weren't that many openly
women living with HIV at the time when I sort of started to speak out, whereas there are now. So I think that, you know, there's all that fear thing. It's my mum that was probably more concerned for me getting nasty comments than I was, because I thought, well, I haven't actually done anything wrong, and I've never been ashamed or embarrassed. It's that thing of it happening to anyone, isn't it? So probably just be a bit kinder to myself, because what we were talking about being a drain and things at the time, you just sort of, I gave myself a really hard time about it, but you can't foresee these things happening. And I think now just more people, more women talking about it, it's just great, because it's a bigger community then, isn't it? And you can kind of feel like, you know, sharing stories, coming together and just evening out the balance of, it's not just men that are living with HIV now, there's a lot more women that are feeling able to talk about it.
So we've talked about many of the issues and challenges that women face in different sectors of society, in different parts of our lives. And we've seen the common themes, whether it's in business, whether it's in sport, media, or in healthcare. Now, what are the things that we can do to change those things? How can we empower women to have different experiences and set up future generations for our children and our children's children to see that benefit sooner and quicker than has been seen before? So just some reflections really in closing from each of you around, what do you think is the one thing that we could do to take that empowerment of women that step further? Kevin, I'm going to start with you.
I think the one thing that I would say is positive role models. You know, things are changing and we have to work towards creating that tipping point where this becomes the norm, that we're having these conversations, that we're creating opportunities for women, and we're looking at the role models which we currently have and saying, this is no longer the exception. This is part of the new rules by which we operate. And what I've really enjoyed in the conversation today is seeing so many similarities between our sectors in health and athletics, in terms of how the power of role models and how we can foster them and cultivate them, but also how we can use those examples to drive real change. So that would be the first thing that I would put on the table.
Neka, can I ask you what your advice and thoughts would be as to where next with empowering women?
I mean, I think knowledge, I think education, and you know, it's a cliche, knowledge is power, but it truly is. And so raising awareness of the issues that we believe are not well understood, including HIV, making discussing them mainstream in conversations, being able to challenge misconceptions, and you know, there are so many myths about HIV, correcting those so that people come to situations from a place of understanding, and only with that understanding I think can you truly be empowered.
Becky, your thoughts?
I think it's about you know, seeking out role models, mentors, being a mentor as well. You know, I've sort of spoken publicly because I wanted to help other people as well, and I do get a lot of private messages asking how I've coped with things, what things I've done, and you know, the fitness side of things was always a thing that helped me feel like me again. So on the days that I didn't feel very good, I could go out for a run or I could go out and ride my bike and just think, you know, this is all really good. And I've had those messages that from women who have then gone on to speak publicly and say, I don't say it like for a pat on the back or anything, it's just that, well, because reading what you wrote and listening to what you have said, you've made me feel that I could be open and honest about that. And then people talking to their families, even if it's not publicly to the whole world, but just being able to say to their family, you know, I'm HIV positive as well. That's massive, isn't it? So, you know, the mentor side of things and seeking out positive role models like you talked about as well, I think, you know.
Yeah, and certainly the openness that you've shown, the vulnerability that you've shown to others, to be able to have that very direct dialogue about something that's deeply personal, but knowing that there's a bigger thing that can benefit from it. I mean, that's a very selfless thing to do, but at the same time, it empowers you as well as those of the people that you're supporting. So I think it's brilliant advice. Natalie, anything that you would...
Yeah, you're right, that vulnerability is critical, because I think when we look at Instagram and we see the sort of not entirely fake portrayal of people's lives, but certainly a polished optic on it, we panic and we think, well, that's not accessible. And for me, accessibility is crucial, combined with education and allyship, to your earlier points. That is crucial. But when you show, okay, we're all human, but these are little hills and then mountains that we can climb together, and I can do it from this place of knowledge, then, I mean, it's drawing on all those strands, isn't it? And taking confidence from that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a similar sort of thing. I think it has to be, you know, the importance of sport in schools, you know, even from that early age, you know, is so critical. I then think it's about, yeah, people having that voice and being able to share that voice. But I also think that, you know, there's so, you know, people achieve things at so many different levels, at so many different areas that they're coming from, and everybody has to have that same equal opportunity to be able to get it and not think, you know, so often people say, well, you've done it this way and that's wrong. It's not, you know, we all go about things in different ways, but we all should have that opportunity to get to where we want to. And I think that's crucial.
I think, yeah, I mean, I think allyship is massively important. Absolutely. I think it's required. And if you think about the intersectionality of it, of what it is to be a woman and the broadness of that, I think it's, we need to get behind all women, and women need to really get behind all women. And, you know, sport can be life changing, and not that you go into the Olympics or you go to the World Cup and you win. It's not even that. It's about the bonds that you make, the things that you learn about yourself, your self-esteem, your confidence, your personality, you know, the doors it opens, the networks that you make. I think that should be there for everybody. And sport can be just the most wonderful place for people. But at the moment, let's be really honest, for a lot of people, it isn't. And I think unless we get talking to those people and listening to those people and understanding what are the barriers and the obstacles, what are the mindsets and the attitudes, and how can we work with different communities to ensure that it works for them.
Totally. And Gareth, the figurehead of Tackle HIV, probably one of the strongest allies I've ever worked with or met when it comes to women. You get the closing word as to how to continue to support and empower women and why it's so important to tackle.
Do you know what, for me, and I'm glad you said that, like, to support women, as much as everybody said, is find role models. So as much as we look to role models, we make sure that we're brave enough to stand up to people who are not role models, who are not positive voices. Yeah. It's understanding that if somebody says something that is offensive in any way, but they don't know it's offensive. Mm. So it's kind of come from a good place. I'm come from a place of negativity. As long as they can handle that, your response comes from a good place. In fact, comes from a better place, because it's a place to educate them.
Yeah.
As long as they can understand that, it's not about conflict. Yeah. It's not about arguments. It's about creating better environments for everybody, in this case females, to be able to flourish in whatever field they decide to be in, mm-hmm. and not be judged purely on something as simple as their gender.
Mm-hmm. So thanks for your time today. I think this has been an awesome conversation, very inspiring to hear from so many different spaces, but so many shared experiences. We do have to close, but if you do want to learn more or join the fight in tackling HIV stigma, then please do follow us at Tackle HIV on social media channels. And if you want more information, then please visit tacklehiv.org, where there's much more information and statistics about the realities of HIV in 2023. So thank you. We'll speak to you soon.